This week on Making Contact.
400,000 people in Britain marched against the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq. Did the New York Times or the Washington Post even bother to cover it, though they had covered the same number of protesters pushing for fox hunting in Britain the week before?
There are countless untold stories around the world that could have the potential of shaping public opinion on key issues if those stories were given access to the airwaves or the establishment press. One journalist who has consistently brought the untold stories to a national audience is Amy Goodman, host of Pacifica Radio's daily program, Democracy Now! On this edition of Making Contact, you'll hear Amy Goodman as she talks about the amount of control major media outlets exert over public opinion and what grassroots activists and independent media are doing about it. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. The voices of the powerful find plenty of airtime. But when it comes to working families, immigrants, or children who may be the next victims of U.S. military strikes, their voices are virtually muted. This is not the case on Democracy Now!, a listener-sponsored program which is broadcast on community radio stations and public access television around the United States. The show's host is journalist Amy Goodman, whose groundbreaking work has earned her numerous awards, including a George Polk Award for the radio documentary Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Military Dictatorship, which she co-produced with Jeremy Scahill, and a Robert Kennedy Prize for International Reporting for the documentary Massacre, The Story of East Timor, which she co-produced with Alan Nairn. On November 9, 2002, Goodman spoke at the Green Festival in San Francisco. She begins by discussing a story Democracy Now! Covered about the deportation of a Pakistani man.
On election day, as the Democrats defeated the Democrats around the country, our producer, Chris Abrams, went out to Coney Island in Brooklyn because she heard that a man who'll just go by the name of Alex, a Pakistani human rights attorney, was being deported back to Pakistan at 5 o'clock that day, and she went to talk to him. Here was a man who had come to this country, he had taken on Musharraf, he had been threatened with death, and he sought refuge here. After September 11th, police were knocking at his door. They didn't have a search warrant. They demanded to come in. He didn't want it to seem that he was hiding anything. He wasn't. He was wearing an American flag, a pin, on his lapel. They stormed his apartment. They dragged him out. They said he had false ID that they'd found in his apartment. They brought him up on criminal charges. Then they had to drop all the criminal charges. He had real ID, but they didn't release him. They handed him over to the INS because of the increasingly close relationship between the police and the INS. And then the INS, with shackling him at his hands, at his stomach, at his feet, kept him in jail for months and then finally deported him. And when Chris asked the organizer, the immigrant organizer, Bobby Khan in Coney Island, how many men like Alex are being picked up every day, he said 2 to 3 a day. Now, did you know this? Is this being reported? As Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, said, no, it's not a police state for us right now. And so when people say that, for many it doesn't ring true, and you say, come on, don't exaggerate. But for many it is. And it is an extremely frightening time, which is why it is so important we shore up forums for dissent. Because when we all stand up, whether or not you agree with everything your neighbor says, when we all stand up together, it is much harder to single out, to isolate a person who is standing next to you. And it is very important right now that we make this country a sanctuary for dissent. This country was founded on the principles of dissent. You think about what happened after September 11th. The USA Patriot Act, one of the little-known sections 215 that goes after librarians, goes after libraries, booksellers, bookshops. And it says that an FBI agent can go into a library and say to a librarian, anyone here with an accent, I want to see what they ask to read. Let's see the books they took out. Let me see the logs of the internet. And who, by the way, goes in and uses the library internet? A lot of people do, but also people who can't afford to have a computer at home. And so poorer people will be targeted in this way, don't have as much confidentiality. And this targets librarians because it says that the librarian cannot say even to another librarian that she or he works with that the FBI has been to see her or him. And if they do reveal this, they could be criminally prosecuted. They can only tell someone that they need to get the records from to hand over to the FBI. The American Library Association has come out against this and has said, don't leave a paper trail to the librarians. No need to keep unnecessary paper on someone who takes out a library book and returns it on time. A good advertising campaign, return your library book or else. But everyone is engaging in resistance in one way or other. And then there's the No Child Left Behind Act that Bush signed into law. Hard to call him President Bush, maybe President-elect, right? Selected, not elected, in the year 2000, or Resident Bush. He resides in the White House. But in the latest issue of Mother Jones, my brother David has a piece called No Child Unrecruited. Should the military be given the names of every high school student in America? And it begins, Sharon Shea Keneally, principal of Mount Anthony Union High School in Bennington, Vermont, was shocked when she received a letter in May from military recruiters demanding a list of all her students, including names, addresses, and phone numbers. The school invites recruiters to participate in career days and job fairs, but like most school districts, it keeps student information strictly confidential. Says Shea Keneally, we don't give out a list of names of our kids to anybody, not to colleges, churches, employers, nobody. But when Shea Keneally insisted on an explanation, she was in for an even bigger surprise. The recruiters cited the No Child Left Behind Act, President Bush's sweeping new education law passed earlier this year. There, buried deep within the law's 670 pages, is a provision requiring public secondary schools to provide military recruiters not only with access to facilities, but also with contact information for every student, or face a cutoff of all federal aid. The military complained this year that up to 15% of the nation's high schools are problem schools for recruiters. Do they mean kids aren't graduating, that they're problem schools? That they're not learning how to read and write? No, problem schools. In 1999, the Pentagon says recruiters were denied access to more than 19,000 schools. Louisiana Republican Congressmember David Vitter, who sponsored the new recruitment requirement, says such schools demonstrated an anti-military attitude that I thought was offensive. And so he sponsored this provision of the No Child Left Behind Act. To many educators, however, requiring the release of personal information intrudes on the right of students. We feel it's a clear departure from the letter and spirit of the current student privacy laws, says Bruce Hunter, chief lobbyist for the American Association of School Administrators. Until now, schools could share student information only with other educational institutions. Now other people will want our list, says Hunter. It's a slippery slope. I don't want student directories sent to Verizon either, just because they claim all kids need a cell phone to be safe. And then the story ends where David interviews a local recruiter in Vermont. Major Johannes Peran, head of the U.S. Army recruiter for Vermont and northeastern New York, told him, "The only thing that will get us to stop contacting the family is if they call their congressmen. Or maybe if the kid died, we'll take them off our list." Now, this is very serious. It means that your child, if they're in high school, their information will be given over, address, phone number, to the Pentagon, to the authorities, unless you proactively say you don't want that information handed over. Many schools just give it over completely, and you have to inform the school that you don't want your child's information given over. I'd like to know how many Congress members read all 670 pages of the, well, the Times cropped it well with the picture of Bush, Child Left Behind Act. Speaking of cropped pictures, I was thinking of Amber Amundsen, who lost her husband Craig Amundsen at the Pentagon on September 11th. He was a graphic designer. He had a bumper sticker on his car that said World Peace. And she marched with other people who lost loved ones at the Pentagon and the World Trade Center from Washington to New York. And when they got to New York, they held a vigil in Union Square. She always wore the American flag as a shawl around her shoulders to reclaim symbols, American symbols for peace, saying peace is patriotic. And so she wore that as a shawl. And there was a picture in the New York Times, a rather big picture, of her and others who'd lost loved ones who were protesting war. And the picture was them standing there, Amber wrapped in the American flag, and there were placards behind her. One placard, well, it originally said no war, but the no was cut off, and so over her head it just said war. And then there was another one that said peace, but the ACE was cut off, so it said PE. War, PE, she's wrapped in the American flag. She said she didn't march for physical education. And the caption underneath said those who lost loved ones at the World Trade Center and Pentagon honor those that they lost. And it says war over her head. No story. They sent a photographer, but that was it. But it gets much bigger than that, and it certainly goes beyond the New York Times. September 11th, the day that terror came to U.S. shores, we were broadcasting Democracy Now! When the second plane hit the second tower of the World Trade Center. It was 9:03. We were blocks from Ground Zero in the garret of this century-old firehouse, the firehouse of Engine Company 31, but now a community media center where people learn how to document their communities, downtown community television. We hardly have windows, so we didn't see what happened. We heard a thud outside, didn't quite know what it was, and we kept broadcasting the program we were doing. We were talking about the significance of September 11th. That's September 11th, 1973, when Salvador Allende was overthrown by the Pinochet regime and died in the palace as Pinochet rose to power. And in those ensuing 17 years, thousands of Chileans died. And we were talking about more declassified documents that had implicated Henry Kissinger, the national security advisor with President, the late President Nixon, who together with ITT and Pepsi-Cola had supported the Pinochet regime and subverted democracy in Chile. That's what we were doing on September 11th. And then the planes hit. The Community Media Center opened its doors to give water to and allow people to use the phones who were running from the World Trade Center. And we started to bring people upstairs who were running from the World Trade Center just to describe what had happened. That was very hard to figure out what was going on at that point. At around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we went outside to see Building 7 go down. It burned and collapsed. And as we were watching it with hundreds of people right behind us, one of the network reporters was standing with the backdrop of Building 7. And as it went down, they were going live to her. And just before the camera went live, she turned to her assistant and said, put some ashes on my shoulder. I didn't know who she was at the time, but weeks later I was looking at MSNBC and I saw her face flash by and it said Ashley Bamfield. We call her Ashes Bamfield.
That's the voice of Amy Goodman, host of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll have more of her talk in a moment. You are listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. We now continue with Amy Goodman, who spoke at the Green Festival in San Francisco on November 9th, 2002.
Our reporter, Anna Noguera, picked up the phone one morning and stayed on all day through the evening, calling the offices of senators. Not asking to speak to the spinmeisters, the spokespeople, not asking to speak to the senators themselves, but just speaking to the person who answered the phone, saying, are you getting calls around war? And they said yes. In fact, Republicans and Democrats, we called 70 offices. She had 26 on tape. 25 of them said the same thing. Overwhelmingly, they said they were getting hundreds, thousands of calls per week. One woman said from a Republican senator, I've gotten 400 today. The women across the aisle has gotten 500. I have six people waiting. And Anna said to them, to her, and how many are against war? She said 90%. And it was true for Democrats as well as Republicans, overwhelmingly against war. It's the story we are not being told. Could you imagine if the mainstream media broadcast twice, three times, five times a peace activist? I mean, my God, when I asked Al Hunt, right, of Capital Gang, we had him on, and I asked why they don't have people advocating against war on Capital Gang. He's considered the liberal of the CNN gang. And he said, we do, we have Pat Buchanan. And I said, and he said, he's against war. I said, yeah. And you know, they had Dick Armey for the minute he too was opposed to war. You'll have the Republican right-wing zealots on, but you will not have the long-time peace activists known in their communities around this country. Why not? Why, I asked Frank Sesno of CNN, why do you pay retired generals, put them on your payroll, when you can get the Pentagon point of view for free, but you don't pay peace activists, let alone invite them on for free, simply invite them into the studios and ask them what they think. Just some balanced journalism. Yeah, you can have the general, but what about the Noam Chomsky or the Cornel West or the Arundhati Roy? Why not? And he said, we've considered that, but no. We've decided against it. And I said, why have you decided against it? And he said, because the generals are analysts and the peace activists are advocates. The generals are analysts and the peace activists are advocates. I need an analyst to figure out that one. I asked if he would consider interviewing Noam Chomsky, and he said, I don't know him personally. And that does seem to be the standard. I was talking to him on an evening of the Overseas Press Club Awards when he was sitting with Richard Holbrook, who he has interviewed many times, the trigger man for the bombing of Yugoslavia. That's how they end up in these studios. They have dinner with them or lunch, and then they invite them in. We have to demand that they open up the spectrum. With the ascendancy of the oligarchy in Washington, Bush, Cheney, the former head of the largest oil services corporation in the world, Halliburton, Condoleezza Rice, who has an oil tanker, Chevron oil tanker named for her in Nigeria, the Condoleezza Rice, and the others. This is the oligarchy. They know what they're doing. This war is about business. And the closer that the Securities and Exchange Commission comes to investigating Cheney, the more scared I get for an Iraqi child. Because every time there are problems at home, they focus our attention abroad. And in this case, it's Iraq, right? The man who is not popularly elected president has declared war on the world. The people in Washington, D.C., and Maryland, and Virginia over the last months were absolutely terrorized by the snipers, never knowing where those snipers would strike next. And why the millions of people terrorized? Because they didn't know what innocent civilian would be picked off next. Well, think about what the rest of the world feels like right now. It's a kind of global sniper politics that is being practiced on the rest of the world. It was Afghanistan, where more than 3,000 Afghan civilians have been killed in this last year, probably closer to 4,000. Who knows how many more, because the Pentagon bought up the exclusive rights to the Iconos satellite imagery because they knew if Americans saw dead Afghan civilians on the ground that they would not countenance that the U.S. population would say, no, we can't be killing innocent civilians. So who knows actually how many were killed. But first it was Afghanistan, then it was Iraq, it is Palestine, then most recently Yemen. We have not declared war on this country, but we just dropped a bomb on them, a missile. And almost no one is talking about the missile that hit in Yemen last week, and now still Iraq. Who knows where the U.S. will hit next? It is very frightening. But when I see something happen, an investigation coming closer to the heart of power in this country, I fear for the Iraqi children. Finally, thinking about that Iraqi child, when I see the photograph of Saddam Hussein in the paper, I think it would be much more accurate to have a picture of a little Iraqi girl. Not with the target on the head of Saddam Hussein, but a target on her forehead, because that's who dies in war. Just listen on a daily basis to Democracy Now! And hear Jeremy Scahill and Jackie Suen's reports from Ground Zero, from Baghdad. As they broadcast these radio and television reports, we're broadcasting, you know, not only on Pacifica Radio here, but also on public access TV stations around the country. As we bring together the public media spaces on Berkeley Public Access TV, you can push to get us on San Francisco Public Access in any community. Many people don't even know they have public access and it hasn't been activated. But the same struggle that was waged for community radio has been waged against the cable monopoly. And so the Time Warners that come in and take over an area, the one concession they've had to make is they have to set aside public interest channels. You have them in your communities, use them, or we will lose them in this age of deregulation. And we've got to put programming on that is made by the community. Democracy Now! Is now being broadcast on radio and television in more than 120 stations around the country, and also on Dish Network, on channel 9415, which is Free Speech TV based in Boulder, another nonprofit channel. Learn about these public media spaces. We must bring them all together with the print press if we're to make a dent in the national and international conversation, if we're to break the sound barrier. We've got to join together. Medea Benjamin talked earlier about Code Pink and all of the women who are going to be coming to Washington between now and March 8th, will be in Lafayette Park and God knows where else, hopefully in Congress, though she has been banned from there for her brave acts, and they are brave. But there are many other people who can go there as well to speak up. Women's call for a peace vigil at the White House, a constant presence that will be there. And it doesn't just have to be in Washington. It is in every community in this country. The New York Times said there were a few protests, not only in cities in the United States, but around the world on October 26th. A few. What, 80,000 here, more than 1,000 in Vermont, and six other protests outside the Capitol. In Taos, New Mexico, more than half the community, 3,000 people showed up outside the house of Donald Rumsfeld. Did you read about that? More than 10,000 in Los Angeles, tens of thousands in Minneapolis, remembering the late Senator Paul Wellstone. One of his first acts was to vote against the Persian Gulf War. One of his last was to vote against the unilateral resolution that would allow Bush to invade Iraq. There is hope. If you compare to what's happening now to the beginning of the Vietnam War, look at what happened in Congress and the Senate. Close to a quarter of the House and the Senate said no to war. There is still hope. What can we do? We can support independent media. We can demand that the mainstream media, that everyone should go to your local papers and national press, not only set the targets as the Pentagon and marching on Congress and marching on the Washington Mall or here in San Francisco, but every major newspaper must be picketed to broadcast and print what is, what I think, not the voice of a marginalized fringe or the silent majority, but the silenced majority. Think about the little girl, the little Iraqi girl. She does not deserve to die because Enron's chief executive, Ken Lay, one of the largest contributors to the Bush campaign, is in trouble. Why should that mean the wiping out of an Iraqi family? I'll just end with a quote. I don't even know who said it, and I hope someone will come up to me after and tell me who did. But that person said, "I look back on all the times that I thought I went too far, and I realize now that I didn't go far enough." Thank you very much.
That was award-winning journalist Amy Goodman, host of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, speaking at the Green Festival in San Francisco on November 9, 2002. To find out where you can hear or see Democracy Now!, visit their website at democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at media and democracy. Thanks for listening. And special thanks to Sarah Olson, who recorded Goodman's speech. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you would like to get in touch with any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Laura Levati is our acting executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, associate producer Amy Pomerlo, women's desk director Lisa Rudman, administrative coordinator Rosalind Fabe, executive assistant Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national producer David Barsamian, and I'm your host and managing producer Philip Babbage. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time.